From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, the 17th of September, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be getting an update, first off, from Secretary of State Jim Condos about mail-in voting. Every Vermonter in the state is going to be getting a ballot in the mail this year, and folks are being urged to fill out those ballots and mail them back to their town and city clerks, or you can go down to your town or city hall and drop them off early. There are a variety of different approaches here. The aim, of course, cut down on crowds on election day because we want to keep up that social distancing because of the coronavirus pandemic. In the second half hour, we're going to be talking with Lauren Traister of Vermont 4-H. She is also affiliated with the UVM Extension, and she's going to be talking to us about how 4-H is adapting to the current COVID-19 crisis and what that means for those youth programs, etc. So that should be an interesting conversation. And then Linda Fowler joins us in the second hour. She's a political science professor from Dartmouth College. Want to get her to weigh in on how she sees the campaigns and the political season shaping up here in the good old U.S. of A. And in between, right after that mid-show break, we are going to be visited briefly by one of the reporters with Axios, the online national online news service. Ursula Perano will be joining us about 5 after 10. So we have a good full show, and I want to get right into it with Secretary of State Jim Condos. Good morning, Mr. Secretary. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, David. It's great to be here.
And tell me about your plans. When should people expect to get their ballots in the mail?
So we've been working diligently on this. We're very focused, and the expectation is the ballots will start being mailed out on Monday, the 21st. So I'd say mid to late week, people should start receiving them in their mailboxes. It'll take us about a week to 10 days to get all the ballots out, but that should occur over the next week and a half.
Okay, and so from starting on the 21st, then the ballots will be in the mail within that first 10 days or so.
Exactly. We expect that by October 1st, everybody that is receiving a ballot will have received it.
Okay. And obviously, it gives you a little over a month to. Are there any recommendations for kind of time you should give your ballot to clear the mails? I've heard people say. In fact, I think I heard an advertisement from the U.S. Postal Service saying that people are urged to get their ballot in the mail a week before November 3rd, Election Day. Is that what you're hearing as well, or do you recommend a couple weeks, or what's the word there?
First off, let me just back up for a second and just say that you started to describe it perfectly early on when you were introducing me. Voters will have several options. So they can put it back in the postage paid envelope and mail it back to their town clerk. The town clerk's address will be on the front of the envelope to be mailed back. You can actually hand deliver it to your town clerk, and many of them will have a secure drop box, whether it be inside or just outside their door. Or you can bring it with you and drop it off at the poll location, which we had a lot of people that did that during the primary. So there are several ways to do it. If you're going to mail it back, we do recommend, we're saying 7 to 10 days. The Postal Service, the Postal Service just put out a postcard, and on that postcard it says at least 7 days. We're not as concerned here in Vermont, but we would recommend at least 7 days. But we say to be sure, do it 7 to 10.
Yeah, okay. And I recall around the time of the primary that there was a question about when the mail-in ballots would be counted, and it was determined that the mail-in ballots could be counted as they were received by town and city clerks. And if I remember the way this went correctly, that was considered to be a boon to the city clerks, town clerk's offices, because they were able to sort of smooth out the workflow over more time, and just in terms of counting the ballots. And it resulted in a really smooth reporting of election results on election night. Do I have that right?
It is. You're correct. And I have to say that typically they, under a normal year, we would have. It's already in statute that they can actually start processing ballots, absentee ballots, the day before the election. We've now extended that to 30 days before the election. And before mm-hmm. anyone gets concerned, nobody knows what the vote totals are. All they will know is how many ballots have actually been processed. So there is a procedure in place to maintain privacy and maintain the integrity of the election. There must be two election officials that are opening those opening the mail ballots as they come in. They then check. Following reading the name off the certificate envelope, which people have to sign, they will then check that person off the checklist, and then they will open that certificate envelope. And if it's a tabulator town, of which about 140 out of 246 towns are tabulator towns, so if it's a tabulator town, they can then. They turn the ballot upside down so nobody can read who's voted for who, and then they can run it through the machine. The machine then will record it, but all the public can see is that only one ballot went through, and that is it. And there's a procedure to maintain that integrity as well. If it's a hand count town, they can open the ballot and put it into a secured ballot box. A locked ballot box to protect the integrity of the election for an election night count. So, we have many procedures in place. The town clerks have been awesome this year working with us. They probably had the smoothest election we've ever had in August. We had 98% reporting by midnight that night. And I think, as a news person, you're familiar with that.
Yep.
So, it's unofficial on election night. There is no state that has official results on election night. It always takes sometimes a week to 2 weeks, to either process ballots or certify the election.
So the, in terms of what the voter will see and do, let's assume for a moment that the voter does decide to go purely mail in. In other words, you get this self-addressed envelope in the mail from your city town clerk, and with a return envelope, postage paid, and you say, I'm going to fill this out, and you need to sign. Is it the outside of the ballot? I mean, walk me through what you have there. You got a couple different envelopes. One gets stuffed into the other, et cetera.
Yeah. So there's so the package includes three envelopes. It includes the outgoing envelope that has all the ballot and associated envelopes within it. Mm-hmm. That ballot, we're doing this from a central mailing house. The town clerks, we worked with the town clerks, and they were very supportive of the idea because they were not sure how they were going to keep up with all these requests or mailing these out. It is a time and resource issue. So there's an outside envelope which will be addressed to the voter. And that outside envelope has the return address of their town clerk. Then when you open that up, there will be two additional envelopes, a smaller one and a larger one. The smaller one is called the certificate envelope. And this is the one that has instructions on it, has a place for you to fill out your name, print your name and your town, and sign it under penalties of perjury that you are who you say you are. Mm-hmm. Once you vote your ballot, you put your ballot. You don't sign the ballot. You put your ballot into this certificate envelope. You seal it. You put that envelope into the return envelope, which has prepaid postage on it, and the address on that should be your town clerk.
Okay. And in terms of the mailing, actually, I saw something online, or all sorts of stories and rumors floating around out there, a couple of which is probably worth knocking down if they're not true, certainly. One thing I heard the other day was that some voters are urging others to put a stamp on the postage paid envelope because that elevates the it elevates this piece of mail from bulk mail to first class, which will get it there faster, supposedly. Have you heard that one, and what do you think about it?
Well, it's not necessary in Vermont because we're using first class mail. It's a postal permit on it, and it's a first class mailing. So we're not advising that. There's no need for mm-hmm. it.
Okay.
Our elections director, Will Senning, has been working with the elections postal liaison from the Postal Service literally weekly since April, and he's been meeting with her. And, everything around the envelope, the postage, the prepaid postage, everything has been run through the Postal Service to ensure that we get high priority status. And that's what we saw during the August primary as well. We had one town clerk, the Lincoln town clerk actually got a call from the Bristol postmaster saying that they had received three ballots that afternoon on election day, and the Bristol town clerk was able, or the Lincoln town clerk was able to send someone down to pick those ballots up. We heard in another town, I think it was Randolph, where the postal workers were going from blue box to blue box, checking for election mail and delivering it to the poll location. So we've had tremendous success here in Vermont. Our union postal workers have been really focused on their jobs and focused on making sure that the mail is processed in a proper way. So we're very confident. Here in Vermont, I can't speak about the rest of the nation.
Well, I was going to ask about that because, when you said that we're doing this by first class mail in Vermont, if that's the norm around the country, or if this talk of adding a stamp to your ballot envelope would make sense in a state like Nebraska or New Mexico or anywhere else?
Well, Dave, I don't know what every other state is doing as far as posting. So we chose to pick up the cost of the outgoing and incoming postage using our CARES Act money that we had received specifically for elections. I don't know if other states, some states are probably paying the postage. Some already did. Other states are requiring the voter to put the postage on. So it really depends on a state-by-state basis. I don't even know if there's a table of states saying what they're doing in this regard. I know that, again, as I said earlier, we've been in weekly contact with our Postal Service liaison, and she has been extremely helpful in making sure that everything we've done is giving us a priority status.
I see. Okay. There is talk, I've read several news articles and magazine pieces and so on about a concern, and again, this is kind of goes to national picture here, and I know your main focus is on Vermont, but I'm sure as someone who watches election matters quite closely, you've probably been hearing this, reading this as well, there's talk that mail-in ballots, if they arrive on or just right around Election Day in many places around the country, may not be counted on Election Day. They will actually be held for counting after Election Day. And this could set up a dynamic where the election results could appear to be pointing in one direction on election night itself. And, as the votes counted so far, we have one candidate in the lead and But then there are all these uncounted ballots out there, and there's talk that the candidate in the lead might start clamoring for, you know, a cutoff of counting. And of course, I think you understand the scenario here. A lot of people are pointing at this. This would be President Trump, who might be ahead on election night in the among folks who went ahead to the polls and lined up. Maybe some of his people without masks. I don't know. And then the mail-in ballots are described as more likely to be used by Democrats. And so Trump's in the lead on election night, and is, you know, clamoring to call it now. And the obviously the Biden camp is saying, let's get all the ballots counted before we call this election. Could take a matter of days or even a week or more. And that gets us into this post-election period of uncertainty and maybe strife. Any worries there?
So let me just start off by saying whether the person in charge of the elections in every state is a Republican or a Democrat, it doesn't matter. We are all focused on the integrity of our elections. So I'd like to start with that premise first. And secondly, we do not declare winners on election night. On election night, those are unofficial results. They always have been here in Vermont. They always have been around the country. Those are unofficial results until the election results have been certified. In Vermont, it's 7 days after the election that we certify. However, going back to your original premise about the when the ballots come in, Vermont law requires all ballots to be received by the town clerk by 7 p.m. on election night. So we do not accept postmarks after the election. And to be quite honest, we've reviewed it over the last few years, and we've seen very little election ballots coming in after the deadline. So people in Vermont are used to the situation. I can't speak for other states. I think that some states have, you know, they accept ballots postmarked on election day 3 days after. Some are 7 days after. Some could be 14 days after. And that goes for overseas and military as well. But our deadline is 7 p.m. on election night, and we've not had a problem before this. We expect there's going to be a lot of social media, press releases, press accounts that that will remind people that we know that the clerk must receive the ballot by 7 p.m. on election night. To your point, I think our election night results page typically has it says unofficial in red letters at the top, so it's very evident. And what happens over the next, the clerks actually have 48 hours to review, verify, and certify their results, which may change from what they reported on election night. And then they will submit those to us, and our office then puts those together into a single tally from all the 275 different polling districts. And on Tuesday at 10 o'clock following the election, we certify the election with representatives from each of the major parties. Those results are certified, and then for the general election, it goes to the legislature for statewide races, and obviously it goes to the Electoral College for the presidency. So, there's processes in place. We are strongly in favor of the high integrity of our election process. And we will continue to work from that standpoint.
Is Fred from Montpelier, you're still on the line?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, Trump is pushing his followers to vote twice. Vote by mail, then go down the polls and vote manually. Are there any safeguards to protect against that? Once it's come in the mail, are they crossed off so they can't vote live? Thank you.
Jim Condos?
I couldn't quite, it was kind of muffled, so I couldn't really hear what he was asking. So maybe you can translate
sure.
it for me.
Yeah, I think it was basically the caller says that President Trump has urged his voters to vote twice, once by mail and once by going down to the polls. And are there any safeguards against this? I think there are, and I'd invite you to explain them.
Yes. So it is a great question, and frankly, what the president is encouraging people to do is to vote twice, and that would be a violation of federal law as well as Vermont law. But in any case, the situation is this. When you vote by mail and that ballot comes back in the certificate envelope, when the town clerk or election official opens that envelope up, they are checking you off on the checklist, the voter checklist, that you have voted, that they've received the ballot from you. Therefore, you cannot ask for another ballot once you have done that. So that's one check off. The other is when you sign that certificate envelope, you're signing under penalties of perjury, which means it could be a felony and a significant fine. And on top of that, voter fraud is I'm not going to say it's non-existent, but it is very, very rare. And in fact, here in Vermont, during my time, there have been a handful of cases of alleged voter fraud that have been usually found to be usually an administrative issue. And in fact, the Heritage Foundation has a database that actually has some 1,300 examples over 40 years of voter fraud. And if you think about how many billions of ballots have been cast during that time and only 1,300 examples, that's pretty minimal. It's several zeros past the decimal point as far as how small it is. But on top of that, they have actually no record of any cases of voter fraud here in Vermont. And that's the point I would like to make is people just don't go commit voter fraud. So we are confident in the systems we have in place, and we believe that the integrity of our elections will be secure.
Are you you say people don't go and commit voter fraud? Are you worried that some might if the president is urging them to do so by voting twice?
We have that system covered as well.
We're about out of time. Jim Kondo, Secretary of State, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
You're quite welcome, David, anytime.
All righty. Going to be speaking with Lauren Traster of 4-H when we come back. Stay with us, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, and thanks for staying with us into the second hour of our program this morning. Lauren Traster is with 4-H of Vermont, and, of course, that program, longstanding. You can maybe get a little of the history of 4-H and find out how it is coping with the COVID-19 crisis and keeping the kids in the program and still working away at their 4-H projects. I believe Lauren Traster is on the phone with us. And the 4-H says here, 4-H has been around for more than 100 years. That's quite a history. Lauren Traster on the phone. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me this morning. I appreciate being here.
So tell me a little bit about 4-H first off. How many kids in Vermont are involved, and And I see it's been around for more than 100 years. And what are its focus? I always think of sort of agricultural programs and projects and so on. Is that still a good way to think about it?
Yeah, so you're right. We have a very long history, over 100 years. Our focus is developing life skills in our young people. So what we, even though agriculture is our roots, a lot of the project work that our young people do is focused around animals and agriculture. But really, it's any project they want to do. We've had young people in the past who've done robotics and mining and everything in between. So the projects that they do is just a means to develop those life skills. And we're really just trying to set our young people up for success as they transition through life, through youth, and eventually into adulthood. We want them to have the skills necessary to be successful in life.
And everything's been shaken up by this COVID-19 crisis. How has it affected the 4-H programs in Vermont, and how are you all adapting?
Yeah, so like everyone, in March, we had to shut everything down. And, our programs are based on experiential learning. And that means hands-on activities, if you're working with an animal, a hands-on activity. If you're doing science, we want the kids to do science experiments. So we had a quickly pivot, like everyone else. But what we realized is the foundation of our programs is based on the essential elements of positive youth development. And a lot of that, when you look at going into the virtual space, we can bring all of the foundation of our programming into that space. So at first we're like, oh, our programs are changing so much. But really it was just the delivery method that we used. We still were doing positive youth development. We still actually could do experiential learning and have our young people engaged and give them opportunities for youth voice and leadership. And then wrapped around all of that, and what 4-H is also, as a youth organization, we make sure the safety protocols are there. So in that virtual space, we brought all of that into it. And this really had a very intentional design process to make sure the virtual space was as enriching as an in-person experience.
Wow. Are the kids staying with it? Are you seeing any sort of drift away happening? How well has it been received?
Yeah, we saw an interesting transition because we have different delivery modes, whether it's in person or virtual. And so we have 4-H youth that are in 4-H clubs, and obviously the clubs could not meet, but right now the clubs can actually resume. So the nice thing is we actually can get some of the young people back into that in-person experience. But what we saw in the virtual spaces, we actually got so many new people into 4-H who had never thought of 4-H and had no experience with us. So while some of our traditional members sort of took a break for a while, we had a flood of new youth that just flocked to our programming and really benefited from those experiences.
And is that largely because, this influx of new people, was that largely because of so many other activities basically being curtailed? Now kids are maybe home from school. They're looking for stuff to do. Let's check out 4-H.
Yeah, so in the beginning, I think March, April, May, schools were having, weren't transitioning to that virtual space, as successfully as they probably are doing it now. And there were a lot of young people who had a lot of time on their hands in March, April, and May. And they were looking for things to do. The other thing that they were looking for was connection. And because our programs are found, go back to the foundations of positive youth development, we brought in one of our intentional design features was a sense of belonging, building connection and relationship. And so the young people who came into our programs got that social connection they were so craving by being on lockdown at home. And once they started coming to our programs and realized, just how much fun they were having, that they were learning a lot, parents were thrilled, they just started coming, they kept coming, and then word got out. Did you know about 4-H? Did you know that 4-H is doing, all these great programs? So we were filling a need at a time where there wasn't a lot going on in during lockdown.
Yeah, that is interesting. And are you hopeful, and how confident are you that as sort of schools and other programming adapt and kind of catch up with this new world with coronavirus present somewhere, that competition for kids' attention may be on the increase again. Will 4-H continue to have the kids showing up, or are they going to drift away again, or what's the sense?
Yeah, that's the big question out there right now. We have been developing programs that we're launching throughout the fall. We're keeping a lot of, again, intentional design to bring kids in for that connection, learning sparks, giving them access to things that maybe they're not getting during the school day, or again, with a lot of programs being canceled. But we're not sure what the demands on time are. So this time we're building all kinds of programs. So we have, yesterday I just started back up, I do teen science cafes, and we've been doing them all through March and all through the summer and took a break and just started up again yesterday. And I had 45 young people sign up. Not all show up, but so that's telling me that the demand is still there. And they will come if you give them something that they're going to learn, that's going to give them a skill. We're building programs that are also going to be what's called asynchronous. So I'm doing a youth environmental summit, which normally is an in-person one-day event. But because of schools not being able to do field trips, and obviously we can't gather 300 young people at the Barry Civic Center, I'm building using a platform called Flipgrid, where we're building the summit virtually, and the young people can come when it fits their schedule over a three-week period. And what I actually hope is that teachers will use the summit as a learning opportunity during maybe the remote learning days that most school kids are having right now. So we're designing our programs to hopefully complement the school day, as well as complement and add to the learning experiences, and give them opportunities where, when if sports or theater or bands get canceled, then they could potentially do one of our programs that would fill that space.
Interesting, and I remember Youth Environmental Summit from when my kids were teenagers a few years back, and it's cool to hear that they are persevering also in this environment here and adapting. Like, that is quite an adaptation to go from a big one-day event to something spread out over 3 weeks. What are the dates on that? That is this time of year, roughly, right?
Yeah, so the registration's open right now, and we're going to open up, I'm calling it a virtual learning community space in Flipgrid. So the space will open up on October 30th, and it will stay open until November 20th. And so when you register for the summit, you get the access code to go into the learning community, and we're going to have roughly about 20 or so workshops that are pre-recorded, just like workshops they would attend in person. And I'm working with our presenters to make sure that they make it engaging. So using Flipgrid, you can pose a question in your workshop, and then the young people will have to give a response. They don't have to, but my hope is by coming into the learning community, they'll use the features of the platform to answer questions. One of the spaces is being called See the Change audio wall, where I hope young people just come in and post, what they hope to see, changes in the world as it relates to the environment. And so my hope is it just becomes really network community, and a way to just connect all the young people in Vermont and even beyond, because we get a lot of young people actually outside of Vermont now participating in our program. And my hope is we just create this really cool community in this online space.
Yeah, that sounds like it will be good for a lot of kids who are looking to get, you know, stay sharp, stay involved, stay thinking, stay learning. That's a great thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned the teen science cafe is starting up back up again yesterday. What are those? Describe to me a typical teen science cafe. What happens there?
Yeah, so for a couple of years now, we've been doing in-person cafes, and then obviously, you know, with the coronavirus, we've had to stop meeting in person. So back in March, we took this very quickly and brought them online. And so what's amazing with the online experience, we went from offering a cafe once, about 6 times a year, to every week. So yesterday was our 21st science cafe since coronavirus. And we invite different scientists and tech specialists to come in and talk about their area of science and their research or their work. And then the young people who participate get to ask questions. And what I love about the virtual space is when what I'm noticing is the young people ask so many more questions in the virtual space than they did in person. And they think being behind the screen, they don't come in with video on. We can do a webinar format. And so they communicate through the chat box, and they can ask, and we use a Q&A box. And so they can ask their questions in the Q&A box, and they can ask it anonymously if they want to. And what I find is because you're not putting yourself out there in front of your peers, they ask so many questions, and they ask these amazing questions, sometimes upwards of 50 questions. And our presenter will answer each and every one of them. So it just becomes this amazing connection with the scientists. Yesterday's topic was mitigating climate change in electrical engineering. We had a professor from the College of Engineering and Mathematical Sciences at UVM talk about, you know, how climate change and the electric grid and the research that he does, how that impacts. And it was fascinating. But next week, we're going to be talking about sharks. And then the week after that, robots. So what we try to do is really showcase all these different science pathways that a young person could go explore, and we connect them to scientists. And again, they get to ask their questions. So it's an amazing thing. I would encourage anybody to come check them out.
Yeah, that sounds very cool. And I think some of the programming kids are getting these days, I kind of go, wow, wish I'd had that when I was in school. And Lauren, is 4-H connected with the University of Vermont Extension Service?
Yeah, we are the youth development program of Extension.
I thought that was the case, but said I better ask before just announcing that. So, and by the way, I should mention this is a resumption of our Seeds to Society segment, a regular Thursday feature on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. And this has been a great thing that we did all the last academic year. A lot of help from folks at the University of Vermont's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, which also is tied with the Extension Service and with 4-H. And we're gonna kick this off again with a new academic year, slightly more truncated. We used to do the second hour of sort of 45-minute segment in Seeds to Society. I know you folks are trimming down a bit because of the whole COVID issues happening affecting UVM. So we're going to devote a half hour or 25-minute segment to the program every Thursday going forward here on the Dave Graham Show. I think well into, if not throughout, the complete academic year here for the University of Vermont. And really appreciate the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Our good friend Rachel Leslie is a key player in putting this all together for us there. And hats off to Rachel and the crew there at CALS and the Extension Service. We get people from there, as well as I think we've had a 4-H'er or two on the program previously, and really appreciate you, Lauren, coming back with us today to talk to us about how the how 4-H is adapting to the COVID-19 crisis. It's just amazing to me how so many programs on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV lately have come down to, so how are you all adapting to the COVID-19 crisis? And it's goes everywhere from just state government agencies to something like 4-H and schools, and that's the new world. And so that's the pretty amazing thing how adaptable human beings can be. One thing I wanted to ask you about also is just in terms of the programming here. What else beyond the Youth Environmental Summit? Think later in the fall, winter, spring. What's on the 4-H 4-H planner for the upcoming year here?
Yeah, we have a lot of amazing programs. I'm not the only one programming. We have a staff of 4-H educators that have come up with some great content. We do an animal scoops program for grades 3 to 5. We have a babysitting course coming up for youth in grades 5 to 8. We know a lot of youth have to be home right now and maybe taking care of younger siblings, so we want to set everybody up for success with that and keep everyone safe. We are doing a diversity, equity, and inclusion program for teens, as well as gardening and nutrition. I have a program that I'm revamping for this time. I do a program called Try for the Environment, where we actually train teens to teach environmental lessons to younger youth. That used to be obviously an in-class program, but we're redesigning it. So we're going to train the teens to teach the lessons virtually to their young students. So that's coming up, as well as a vet science program. And we are also collaborating with the Governor's Institute to do a virtual Governor's Institute on advanced leadership. And I'll be one of the key faculty on that program. So 4-H works, with ourselves, but we also partner and collaborate with others because our goal is just to make sure our young people here in Vermont and beyond can just keep learning during this, crazy time that we're all living in.
Crazy times that we're all living in, but 4-H soldiers on, and I really hats off to you folks. I think you're doing good work, and I appreciate your willingness to come on here and tell us about it, Lauren Traister. I'm wondering if kids want to reach out to 4-H and start looking at what the programs are. I gather there's a website somewhere they can go to.
Yeah, there is www.uvm.edu/extension/youth/4-H-home, or Google Vermont 4-H, and then when you get to the menu, look for our 4-H at home, and it lists all of our programs.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, Lauren Traister, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's great talking with you, and wish you luck as you continue navigating this era here. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Let's go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News. We'll be back with one of our journalists from Axios on the other side. Stay with us, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back. Thanks for staying with us into our second hour on this Thursday morning, September the 17th. And I believe we have with us on the phone Ursula Perano. She is with the national online news service Axios. And Ursula, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Hey, I was looking over the Axios reporting from this morning, the Mike Allen top 10 list, and one thing that he mentioned that was pretty interesting to me was just sort of worries about this vaccine rollout and the is it going to be politicized? Is it going to be rushed? Brought to the market just as soon as it can be, because we want to try to restore people's good health. What's the current read on that?
It's definitely going to be politicized in some way, and people are going to have varying degrees of comfort with the vaccine. It is undeniable that this vaccine is being at least rushed to an extent. We want it fast, obviously, to get back to our pre-COVID lives. But in doing that, there have been pushes by the FDA to go at faster speeds than perhaps would happen with other vaccines. There have been emergency use authorizations for different types of COVID treatments. You know, there are a lot of sort of health procedures that are going at a very fast pace right now. And so when the vaccine comes out, it's going to be a matter of convincing people that the vaccine wasn't so rushed that it became inadequate. You know, there are 8 potential vaccines in late-stage clinical trials right now, and the first one could be submitted for review as early as October or November, and then a succession of them could come months after that. We're going to need more than just one vaccine simply for production purposes. One company can't make them all to go worldwide. But each and every company, especially since many of the vaccines are going to have different approaches to how they mitigate the virus in people's bodies or how they create immunity, it's going to be a step-by-step, case-by-case thing where they're going to have to say, here's our vaccine, here's what we did to make sure it was okay, and here's why the public should be comfortable taking it.
Is there any chance that some people might end up wanting to have more than one vaccine because they could, you know, sort of cover, I don't know, different ways in which the coronavirus attacks the body, or you know, one ends up being better than the other, so I take the sort of first one out of the box because I'm eager to have some protection against coronavirus. And let's say I do that in January, but then a better vaccine comes out in March. Do I go back and say, hey, I want the better vaccine, or am I disqualified because I took the one in January, or how does all that unfold?
Yeah, I'm not a medical expert, but I do know that if there is room for people to take multiple vaccines, I think that's a very practical thing we can expect, especially because the standards for immunity within these vaccines are actually not that high. You're not going to get a 95% immune rate. It's just going to make you maybe 60 to 70% less likely to get it. And so when other vaccines come out down the line that might have a better percentage of creating immunity or that have produced better results, you could definitely see people lining up to get a second dose if they can. And it's important to remember that once the vaccine comes out, it's not going to be everybody goes to their doctor's office and gets it all at once. It's going to go to high-risk populations first and medical responders, and then we're going to have these sort of triages of who gets it first, and it's going to take a while to get through to the general population. I expect it to be, you know, the senior population going down and infants a little bit going up, but the 20s, the 30s, the 40s people who are perfectly healthy and otherwise not at risk of adverse effects from the coronavirus, they're going to be in line for a while.
Yeah, that is something to, and I'm sure there will be lots of consternation and maybe political debates about that. Who knows? But there you go. That's now yesterday, I guess the head of the CDC, Dr. Robert Redfield, came out with some comments where he basically was saying, you know, stick with wearing masks, folks. They are, I think he said, if I got this right, more effective than he expects a vaccine to be at slowing the spread of the coronavirus. And then, of course, President Trump came out and said he was confused. Dr. Redfield is confused and basically got that wrong. Whom should the public believe here?
Redfield is a very competent guy and public health expert. I think when he was speaking in that context, he perhaps maybe just took that out of context a bit. You know, he was speaking in the context of now. We need to be wearing masks. That is the best way to mitigate the virus. And I think his argument more so is that when the virus comes out, as things are rolling out and it takes some time and we're waiting to see how high the response can be from the virus in creating immunity, masks are our best option, not necessarily that they end up being more effective. But that was the quote that he said. You know, he said, if you ask me, sometimes I would even say that masks could be more effective than the virus. So That yep. quote did create a little bit of heat yesterday, but I'm sure we'll get some follow-ups in maybe the next day or two where he seeks to clarify. He's a pretty well-spoken guy, pretty vocal about these things, and he's received well by the public, so I'm sure that he will have some clarification for us soon.
Yeah, and of course the him kind of backing down on that, which he pretty much has to, because I mean you're answering two different questions when you're asking about the relative effectiveness of a mask versus a vaccine. That's just, it kind of doesn't make sense. It reminds me of when my oldest son was 5 or 6 years old, and he used to say, "Dad, who do you like better, the Boston Symphony or the Boston Red Sox?" How do you figure that one out, you know? And
yeah,
so
two different things, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't really think there's all that much to worry about in this whole little dust up. But it is just, I mean, it's another one of these 3 hour scandals or three hour bits of excitement that appear on the national news radar screen. And meanwhile, the I'm seeing reporting in some quarters that the administration seems to be interested, zeroing in, I don't know exactly the degree to which this is all happening, but on this idea that maybe the way to address the coronavirus is to try to pursue herd immunity, and then others come out and say that would be a real nightmare. So what are we hearing about all that?
I've heard mixed reporting on the herd immunity idea. The idea of it is if enough people get the coronavirus, and especially expecting that a certain number of people and a surprisingly high number of people would be asymptomatic, that they would build antibodies and we would all be fine and the virus would sort of dissipate in the meanwhile while there's this mass immunity from populations that have already had it. It is not the approach backed by a public health expert at this time. Social distancing to continue and masks to continue and then to really fight for a virus in the meantime is the approach. But there have been certain Trump administration officials that have sort of vocalized that this could be a meanwhile approach or at least, you know, if it happens, great, sort of. But it definitely, public health experts are not saying that should be the target.
Yeah, I'm seeing estimates that we could face a couple million deaths as opposed to a couple hundred thousand in pursuing herd immunity. And, you know, that's a completely different scale, obviously. And I don't know whether there's some hyperbole there or whether that's actually based on well-reasoned, you know, epidemiological theorizing here. But certainly it makes my eyebrows raise to think, what, they want to do what? And so I don't know. A lot of this is whether it's a vaccine you're contemplating or wearing a mask, continuing to wear a mask. Most of this is just playing the odds. There's no airtight answers, it seems here, but, you're always trying to reduce your percentage chance of either contracting or spreading this disease, I gather. Is that roughly right?
I mean, it's a disease that we're learning about along the way. You know, when we started out, it was about touch. It was about surfaces and don't touch anything, use hand sanitizer. I remember I was walking around with a bottle of hand sanitizer dousing myself like every 10 minutes. So that was the start. And then we go to breathing and then we go to social distancing. And now at first it was no mask. Now it's mask. It's just this evolving thing that we're having to settle with, and I think we've come to some conclusions that are going to get us out until we get universal vaccinations. You know, social distance, keep the small groups, wear your mask in public, do try and wash your hands frequently. I think these things are going to write us out, but it is a matter, it's a community effort to keep this so low, and we're counting on people being tuned in, staying aware of the virus, and making sure that they are keeping up to date with what they can do to prevent the spread. But at the same time, people are tuning out of the coronavirus news cycle at an alarming rate. Stories are not getting the same traction. It's becoming this sense of new normal. Therefore, people are becoming sort of numb to it. And that's going to be a scary thing when you think about the fact that this isn't going away for at least another year. We're not going to see sort of a complete return to the normalcy that we once knew.
Well, I think it's going to be a challenge for the news media to even keep its own personnel, editors, reporters, broadcasters, producers, et cetera, interested because, you know, we're always looking for the new thing. That's part of big part of the word news. and as the coronavirus gets to be an older story, really, it's going to be, you know, I think it's going to be a challenge, including an ethical challenge, frankly, for the media to continue to do its job of keeping the public up to speed and keeping the public aware that, you know, the public health crisis remains and that our vigilance needs to remain as well. So, yikes, here we go. Ursula Pirano of Axios, thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you. I believe we are going to be talking shortly with Linda Fowler, a professor at Dartmouth College, with teaches political science at the Hanover campus, and I believe she's actually on the line with us. We've tracked her down, so that's a good thing. That was part of the plan, after all. Linda Fowler, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, working on an article, trying not to drown in all the news articles about the election.
Yeah, wow. You are working on an article that you are writing right now?
But, yeah, it's on gerrymandering.
It's on gerrymandering, and well, tell me about that. Now you have me curious. What's going to be the gist of the article, if you don't mind, or maybe I need to wait till it's published. Is it do not open before Christmas?
Let's wait till it's finished. It's still in preliminaries.
I see. Okay. All right. I don't want to get ahead of the game here.
Right.
So there's plenty of other stuff to talk about that has already happened. So we'll wait until maybe have you back to talk about your gerrymandering article after it appears. And it's good to have you back on the show. You haven't been here in a while, and I kind of been meaning to catch up with you and just get your thoughts about the current state of the campaign season here. I mean, we are fewer than 50 days to go before the presidential election. Let me ask you first, what is your read of the situation? Do you think that the president is really in deep trouble, as some of the pollsters are saying, or is he going to pull this one out, or any sense?
Well, after 2016, I'm skeptical about everything and make no predictions. So I'm glad I'm not in their profession, that I get to be more detached. I've been struck all along that really going back to February, a colleague whose opinion I really respect, has done forecasting models for a long, long time. And he's now decided with this election that he's had to change his forecasting model, which he's been using for decades with very good results. And there are a bunch of reasons for that, of course. We've never had the precipitous decline of the economy that we had in from March until early summer. We've never had a president who's never crossed the 50% threshold in public approval. We've never had a pandemic.
Yeah.
And so... So I think anybody who's prudent, you know, has to reexamine everything that they thought they knew about American politics in light of these things. So initially, the forecasting models that my colleague produced showed that the election would be very tight, that it was basically a toss up, and that was in February or January pre-COVID.
Mm-hmm.
His new model looks just at presidential approval, and that suggests that increasingly the presidential race is tied heavily to approval, and in light of that, Trump is in trouble. But it is also the case that the Electoral College is what determines the presidency, not national polls. So
yep.
The most interesting polls to watch are not the national ones, which show Biden with a lead that appeared in June and really has it's shrunk a little bit, and it varies depending on whether you look at likely voters or registered voters. Likely voters are more favorable, a little bit more favorable to Trump, but still show Biden ahead. So the real interesting thing is are the polls in the battleground states, the roughly 13 states that will determine this election. And at least in some of them, that where Trump won in 2016, notably Michigan, it looks like he's just in a hole in Michigan and can't seem to figure out how to get out of it. In some of these other states, it's a lot closer. New Hampshire, for example, has become a battleground state. And I would remind all your listeners, by the way, that in 2000, when the election went to the Supreme Court, had Ralph Nader not gotten 7,000 votes in New Hampshire, Florida would not have mattered. That it was close between Bush and Gore in 2000, and assuming that people who voted for Gore were, I mean, voted for Nader were more likely to vote for Gore than Bush, New Hampshire could have been decisive. And so what we're seeing now is the president's campaign is starting to pay more attention to New Hampshire because it looks like Michigan is off the table, and that's why you also saw him going to Nevada. Again, a small number of electoral college votes, but I think it's a sign that how worried the campaign is that they're now spending time in states that they originally weren't intending to spend time in.
Are there any states which went for Hillary Clinton in 2016 which are now appear to be leaning toward Donald Trump?
Not really.
Okay.
I think the one that the Trump people would hope would be New Mexico, but I'm not. But that's not that clear. And then you have these sort of congressional districts. So Nebraska allocates its electoral college votes by some of them by electoral college. By congressional district, and so does Maine. So there's some chance that one of the congressional districts in Maine could go for Trump, even though the rest of the state goes for Biden. So there are some kind of wrinkles, and in a very tight race, these would matter quite a bit.
Yeah, that is. Let's see. I believe New Hampshire has two representatives in the U.S. House. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I was
speaking of Maine. Maine is the same, though. Two also from Maine.
Yes, but Maine. Yep. Maine's not a winner-take-all system. States that aren't are Nebraska and Maine and everybody else. And the winner-take-all system really is what was so beneficial to Trump because he won a pretty convincing electoral college vote. But as your viewers, your reader, your listeners probably remember, in total, the difference in the electoral college votes with Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin was only about 72,000 in total. So I think where the action is in the electoral college, and it's difficult to generalize because we have better polling in some states than others. And if you recall, the Hillary campaign in 2016 didn't poll in Wisconsin, so they got blindsided by Trump's victory there.
Which way is Wisconsin leaning right now, or is it too close to call there?
Right now, it seems to be leaning towards Biden. And another target that the Trump people thought they had in the Upper Midwest. Please note how important the industrial heartland is to this race, and initially the Trump people thought they had a shot at Minnesota as well, and that appears to be an interesting case. I think one of the most interesting states to me is Iowa. which is very much in play this year, having gone quite handily for Trump in 2016. Mm-hmm. And the wild card there is whether farmers who are struggling and were harmed quite significantly by the tariff wars that Trump initiated with China, mm-hmm. how the farmers were going to react to that. Now, there was a lot of agriculture money pumped in as emergency aid for farm states like Iowa, but almost all of it went to the big industrial growers. So the family farmers in places like Iowa are really desperate and struggling, and they tend to act on their despair at the voting booth rather than just go off and sulk. So
yeah.
So I think we don't really know what the impact of that is until Election Day. How they're gonna break it. You know, having supported Trump the last time, it's not going to be easy for some people. Other people are saying already that it's quite easy, that Trump has been disappointing to them. So,
a lot of it depends. We're actually coming up on a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News and a couple words from our sponsors. Just a CBS News minute. Linda Fowler, I hope you'll stay with me to the other side of the break. I have some more questions for you, and we will be back in just a couple minutes, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back. My guest is Linda Fowler. She is a professor of political science at Dartmouth College. And Linda, wanted to check in with you about a couple of just things that occurred to me recently about the campaign. And one is the kind of solidity of President Trump's base. I saw a really interesting piece in Axios just this morning, I believe it was, wherein they were interviewing folks in what are called the Wild Counties. There are three counties outside of Milwaukee whose names start with two or W's and one's an O, so I guess it's the Wild Counties. Weird acronym there. And very Republican territory was the emphasis of this. Several of the folks they interviewed, just regular voters, zeroed right in on the abortion issue as a key reason that they were voting for. They don't like Trump very much, but they feel like he is he's gonna put the brakes on abortion, especially with some coming judicial appointments. What should people think about the fact that, I mean, how big an issue is that, and is it kind of exaggerated beyond all reason, or what do you think about that?
Well, that was certainly an issue for many evangelicals in 2016 who were put off by the moral character of Mr. Trump, but felt that he would be do what they wanted to see happen with respect to abortion and judges. And they believe he's followed through on that. For them, the nomination and confirmation of Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court he kept his part of the bargain. The same with Gorsuch. So that's nothing new. I mean, we've had single issue voters in this community, and abortion and guns are two of the issues in which people basically, you know, rank that issue over everything else. I think and when you talk to people who are still supporting Trump, what they will say is, you know, the economy was pretty good, or was very good for me and my and mine until COVID. And so I think the issue there is whether people hold Trump responsible for the damage that COVID has done to the economy, or whether they see his handling of the health crisis as prolonging the damage to the economy. And again, what we know from political psychology is that people have perceptual screens that they bring to candidates. And they often bring their opinion of the candidate into line with their partisanship. So if somebody starts with a strong predisposition of being a Democrat or being a Republican, they tend to kind of suspend opinions on some issues that kind of don't fit with their predisposition. A tough one for many Republicans right now is the size of the deficits that have resulted from the economic dislocation. But we know people in both parties do this. It's called cognitive dissonance, and they have perceptual screens that sort of help them work out the conflict between what they believe is partisans and what the candidate is actually doing. And these are pretty powerful psychological devices. It's also the case that people are being inundated with misinformation from all sources, lots of different sources, and they're passing things on in very uncritical ways. And the major media, social media companies have certainly been very late in trying to put a handle on it. It's interesting that print media have to observe fairly stringent standards about checking sources and being able to verify things. And it's the Wild West on social media. And people who spend a lot of time on social media are much more inclined to believe conspiracy theories and all kinds of outlandish things. And we're seeing some of that carrying over into the congressional primaries, where there are several Republican nominees in safe seats who are sympathetic to QAnon and a variety of other kinds of crazy things.
Yeah. One more question on the pro-life argument. I actually did a little arithmetic the other day, and figured out that if the United States had the same per capita rate of deaths from COVID-19 that Vermont does, the nation would have about 30,000 deaths to date instead of about 200,000 deaths to date. Some of those 170,000 extra deaths have to be, in fact, a lot of them have to be attributed, I would think, to just management, leadership style, et cetera, right?
And the estimate of the deaths is probably low because they only count people who were diagnosed and were often are heavily oriented towards hospitalization. So lots of people seem to be, probably weren't counted. But go ahead and finish your thought. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay. I mean, so I'm wondering, could Democrats argue, especially on to people who, see themselves as pro-life, this president has not been doing a great job protecting life. If you realize that here's a state with a Republican governor, by the way,
yeah,
which has a management style on the COVID-19, which frankly seems to work a lot better than what has been what the sort of national average is. And what about those lives?
Well, this is where many people don't hold Trump responsible for them, and he doesn't himself say he's responsible. Some people say, that the experts were blindsided by this disease, as he was. I don't think that's a plausible argument, but again, when people are dealing with cognitive dissonance, they turn to arguments like that. Some people would say, well, lots of countries, you know, had unusually high deaths, and on a per capita basis, ours are bad, but other countries are bad too. So that, you know, then you'll get whataboutism. And yeah. There's an effort to sort of say, well, this is all China's fault, and when Trump took the courageous action of closing our borders to China, which didn't actually really happen. There were so many loopholes. And he was criticized by Joe Biden. So I think in this polarized electorate where party identities are so strong, it's just really hard to break down attitudes along the lines that you're talking about.
Yep.
I do think that there is an argument, and where COVID has really been harmful and to Trump and helpful to Biden is that a major block who supported Trump in 2016 were senior citizens. And senior citizens have borne a heavy burden with the death rate. Another group of who were a part of that 2016 coalition and could have been considered part of the base has been peeling off. And this is where I don't see that Biden has made overt overtures to them saying, you know, Trump is killing you. But there is a sense there that a population that's quite vulnerable to the disease is taking a hard look at Mr. Trump's candidacy. The other one are women. People forget that despite the fact that Hillary was female, that white women voted in favor of Trump. And they are taking a hard look at that. And again, women are much more attuned to health problems and health care and school closings and all of the disruptions, because women bear more responsibility for keeping their families healthy and making sure that they're educated. And so the other place where there's slippage is among particularly non-college educated women who supported him and are now moving away. And that's true in the exurban areas and the suburbs. It's not clear, since we don't have very good polling about rural voters, sort of how this is cutting with rural women.
Yep. Let me bring in a listener who's on the line. Fred from Newbury is calling in. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, the interesting thing about Trump is, and the reason why he's going to lose, is Trump is just not likable. He's not a likable guy. Who would want to have a cup of tea with Trump?
Okay, well, but what about, I'm more of a coffee drinker myself.
I take it Fred would not. Or a beer.
Fred, would you like to have a beer with Trump or a cup of tea?
Well, I'm a political aficionado, and I'd love to have a cup of tea with both Joe and Trump.
Okay.
But, I mean, you know, most people, I mean, you know, you and your guest are both political aficionados, so, you know, you'd have a cup of tea with them too, right?
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
There you go.
I probably wouldn't have a beer with Trump, or at least he wouldn't have one because he doesn't drink, but I might have beer while he had a cup of tea. So,
the whole idea is that we're all political aficionados, like politics. We want to see what's going on, and most people aren't into politics, and they wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole. That's why he's going to lose.
I don't know, Fred. No, I bet you a lot of people would, just the kind of the celebrity factor, would be kind of curious enough to, you know, I'll go share a beverage with
him. I think Fred, though, is onto something important. And that was, there was a likability was a big problem for Al Gore in 2000, and people often said you'd have a beer with George Bush and you'd shoot the breeze with him and talk about baseball and other kinds of things, and you'd never do that with Al Gore, and that same likability factor was a big problem for Hillary. A lot of people respected her, admired her experience, and and so forth, and they just really didn't like her very much. And and that was particularly true for men. And so so Biden doesn't have that burden. His problem is really among young people, who and Latinos, who may who are just not very excited about him and don't really see much in him and his approach to politics that is going to motivate them to turn out. So it's not likability, it's relatability, which is very generational.
Interesting. Fred, thank you for the call. And Linda, one of the topics I wanted to cover with you this morning, I have a little theory I'd like to try out on you and see what you think. I think this idea of coastal elites in this country way overplayed. I think that that it's kind of a fiction, really. And how do you think that's playing? I mean, I saw something online yesterday where this person was talking about her home area in southeast Missouri in the Ozarks and how folks there they don't really care anything about issues. They don't really care what Trump does or what he says or his behaviors. They just want to poke a finger in the eye of liberals. And they see Trump as their instrument for doing that. This is sort of a story that's been promoted for a quarter century or so. I think a lot by Fox News, for instance, that we have these coastal elites in this country that need a comeuppance, and that is what is motivating a lot of folks out there. Do you think that's true? And do you think that there really are reasonable reasons to or arguments to say we do have coastal elites in this country who deserve a comeuppance?
Well, I certainly think the phenomenon of people wanting to send a message to people that they perceive as being a member of some kind of coastal elite, I think that phenomenon is real. And that's, of course, what, as you correctly say, people like commentators at Fox News are pitching. Another way to look at this is that Americans agree on an awful lot. I just saw a really interesting article about on so many issues, you know, that you're seeing majorities of 60% to 70% of people who have the same view, whether it's everybody should wear a mask or we should have health care for more people, or a whole bunch of things. And and if that's true, then the divide between the coastal elites and everybody else, of course, is a fiction. But it's all about strategic rhetoric. I mean, arguably, people who live in Berkshire, Vermont, are considered part of the coastal elite, and yet some of them might consider they have more in common with somebody from Western Wisconsin, Northwestern Wisconsin. So it's really a rural-urban divide. I mean, arguably, Chicago is, well, they do have a coast on the Great Lakes, but or Houston or Dallas. These are all blue areas in potentially red states. So it's really an urban rural and divide. And what's interesting is that the suburbanites for many years have allied with the Republican Party for reasons of taxes and government expenditure and social welfare and so forth. And what's really changing is that suburbanites, particularly those with high education and professional backgrounds, whether they live in Atlanta or New York, are part of this so-called elite, which is to say that they embrace more liberal views on social issues, whether it's racial tolerance or tolerance of homosexuals or belief in science and so forth. And so you're finding these people all over the country, which is why you get the 65% agreement on so many national issues. And so it's a youthful elite. But I have to say a lot of liberals certainly have played into this. I don't know if you remember the mockery that Barack Obama encountered when he was trying to tell Iowa farmers that they should start raising arugula instead of soybeans. And, you know, you just want to smack the side of your head and go, you know, what was he thinking? And the worst, of course, was Hillary Clinton's view, remark that there were just some people who were a basket of deplorables because they had unacceptable views.
Right.
But it's not just liberals who do this kind of stereotyping. If you recall, Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee in 2012, got into trouble by implying that 48% of the country was basically on the dole and would never vote for him. And the implication was, you know, that Democrats are losers and taking public money and so forth. And the thing that I've always had difficulty with is how Republicans can say both that, you know, we're talking about elites here, but we're also talking about welfare queens. Is it?
Some nasty mix of all of the above. I don't know.
Yeah.
At least in that perspective. But it is amazing. The categorizations, I mean, one thing that I've urged just in, like, online debates and stuff a little bit over time recently is don't make assumptions about groups to which you do not belong. You start making statements about groups to which you do not belong, and you will automatically run into factual error right off the bat. I mean, just a few make a blanket statement. You know, all conservatives oppose abortion. There are a few conservatives out there, all conservatives believe it should be illegal. There are a few conservatives out there who lean more libertarian on that. Let's see, I missed that. How much time do we have left? I thought so. Linda Fowler, political science. I'm afraid so. Political science professor at Dartmouth College. There we go. I got that out. I want to thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's great talking with you, and we should do this again soon.
Yeah, I'm sure we will, Dave, now that I'm not traveling so much. Take care.
All right.
Bye now.
Thank you. Take care. That's about it for today's Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. Join us again tomorrow at about 9:05. And meanwhile, stay tuned today for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. Keep those masks up and social distancing. Stay healthy, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.